From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, students play market sharks with electricity and carbon trading.
We can tell them certain things about certain conditions in which it may be easy for a firm to raise prices. But until they actually do it themselves, you know, it doesn't really sink in.
And activists argue it's high time gay men were allowed to donate to blood banks. Also, blood in the water. A surfing cops and robbers movie so bad, it works better as theater. I'm Rachel Miro. Glad you could join us for this edition of the California Report. A federal bankruptcy judge ruled Friday on a reorganization plan for the North Coast's Pacific Lumber Company, also known as PALCO. This signals the beginning of the end for what is now 18 months of bankruptcy court proceedings and more than 20 years of controversy for the iconic timber company. Tamara Keith has been poring over the judge's 120-page ruling and joins us now. Tamara, there were five different reorganization plans before the judge. Which one did he select?
He chose the one from the Mendocino Redwood Company, though with three technical changes. And this was the plan that was supported by Governor Schwarzenegger and also most of the creditors. And it comes from the Fisher family. They own the Mendocino Redwood Company, and that's the family that founded the Gap.
So what is it they're proposing to do?
Well, they're proposing to continue operating the Pacific Lumber Company, continue foresting the redwood timberlands, continue operating the mill and all of those things, but to do it in a more sustainable way. Back in April, I went up to the forest run by the Mendocino Redwood Company and spent some time with Chief Forester Mike Janai. We were in this heavily wooded area when he described his philosophy of what they call selective harvesting.
Once we leave, we like to look back and say, hey, you still have a forest there when we're done doing our harvesting.
And he's promising to do the same thing in the forests up in Humboldt County. They actually want to get Forest Stewardship Council certification, which is the most stringent certification you can get to say that you're sustainably managing a forest.
Now, what about all the folks with competing plans who were disappointed?
Absolutely. The largest, most disappointed group, I guess you could say, are what's known as the timber note holders. They owned the timberlands and felt that the land was worth a lot more money than the Mendocino Redwood Company was offering for it. But in the judge's ruling, he said that that plan was not proposed in good faith and that it was laden with conflicts of interest, that it was more about liquidating the assets than reorganizing. That plan would have auctioned off the land. The other plan, the plan from the Pacific Lumber Company, they had three different plans, actually. Eventually, they basically folded their cards and put their support behind the Mendocino Redwood Company plan. I spoke earlier with George O'Brien, who's the president and CEO of the Pacific Lumber Company.
The operations are going to continue on the timberlands. The mill is going to continue to operate. You know, the town is still here. We supported their plan, and so, you know, we congratulate them on the ruling today.
So what about the environmentalists who've been watching this case real close?
Oh, they've been watching it very closely. They have been at odds with Pacific Lumber Company and their parent company, Maxam, for a very long time. It's been very contentious, and the environmentalists I've spoken with today are quite happy. This is Paul Mason, who's deputy director of the Sierra Club.
The last 23 years since Maxam took over Pacific Lumber Company have been an environmental catastrophe in Humboldt County. It's been decades of strife in the local community. And the fact that we're now looking at a new era where Mendocino Redwoods is proposing to log at roughly one-third the rate that Pacific Lumber has been recently and bring some stability back to the timber economy in Humboldt County, that's nothing but good news.
Good news as far as some environmentalists see it. Where do we go from here?
Well, there are a couple of substantive hearings scheduled for next week to work through those technical changes to the Mendocino plan. There could also be an appeal of some kind, but the Mendocino Redwood Company is already working to gain the regulatory approval needed to take over timber operations. They're getting ready to take over.
Tamara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The California Report's Tamara Keith. This past week, the U.S. Senate began debate on comprehensive climate change legislation, and then days later, the bill's backers pulled it from the floor for lack of support. Here in California, we've already got a landmark law called AB 32 that requires quantifiable greenhouse gas reductions, and the requirements get tougher as time goes on. Among other things, state regulators may soon set up a system known as cap and trade. That is, regulators set mandatory limits on various kinds of industrial emissions. Companies that need to exceed their limits or caps can buy permits from firms with allowances to spare, hence the phrase cap and trade. Stop rolling your eyeballs back. Come with me to the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, where we can learn more together with students. The class is Energy and Environmental Markets in room C210. There are two professors, Severin Bornstein and Jim Bushnell. Bushnell leads the post-game analysis of a computer simulation of an electricity market.
So this is game A, round one. What was your thought process in putting together your bids for your portfolio?
So we were at portfolio seven. And we had
competing groups of classmates, each with different portfolios of power generating plants, vied with each other to get the best price for their power over 3 weeks. After the first round, they had to reduce their carbon output by 10% and trade that. The carbon permit part is fairly new, but Professor Bornstein says the market simulation was born back in 1999.
We first introduced the electricity strategy game during the electricity crisis so students would have a better understanding of what went wrong in the California electricity market by actually putting them in the position of firms who are deciding how much to produce and how much to charge.
A couple years after California deregulated its electricity market, energy traders figured out how to game the market, nearly bankrupting the state's biggest utilities. Bornstein and Bushnell predicted that would happen because of the way the market was structured. They were ignored at the time, but in the classroom, it's striking how quickly students learn to manipulate the market all on their own. Class lesson number one, in any market, social concerns, even broader economic stability, take a back seat to making money as efficiently as possible. Professor Bushnell.
Now in game A, these guys bought up most of the credits and they announced, we're tearing up half the credits, and so you got to pay us a high price if you want to get carbon credits from us. Was anybody surprised by this? Or was sort of the rumors floating around? You guys were? Yeah, you guys were kind of upset, as I recall.
You can see how real market regulators lose sleep at night. Professor Bornstein says it's critical to stress test your market design before you ring the opening bell.
What's going to happen in the real world when some people are out to make as much money as they can?
He's not just talking from the sheltered confines of the ivory tower. Bornstein and Bushnell both have experience as electricity regulators in California. Many of their students have gone on to work as energy regulators, and it's a fair bet some will serve as carbon trading regulators, too. Given the growing interest in green energy and climate change, Bushnell says this class draws students from three fields of study: public policy, business, and science.
And we try to mix them all up on the team so the teams will have sort of one of each of these types. I think they learn as much from each other as they do certainly from us.
The professors also offer an executive edition of the game for any politician or regulator willing to play.
We can tell them certain things about electricity markets, about certain conditions in which it may be easy for a firm to raise prices. But until they actually do it themselves, you know, it doesn't really sink in.
That was the case for Greg Croft, a second-year doctoral student in geoengineering. California history taught him about the potential for energy market manipulation, so he expected that. But he was taken aback by the way energy prices in the simulation rose when carbon trading was introduced 4 days in.
It hugely increased the electricity prices. It's just a 10% change in the carbon. And it sounds like this has happened in previous years. I mean, this is the only example I've seen, and we had two different games going within the class. It happened in both games. But a lot of people, I think, may not realize the cost effect of trying to phase out carbon, especially if it's done rapidly.
Cap and trade is not the only strategy under serious consideration by economists, environmentalists, and public policy wonks. The other big idea on the table? Simply tax emissions. Outside the classroom at Haas, first-year student Ryan Drake Lee explains.
I would say that Taxes are one way that I feel is close to internalizing the external costs of using electricity and generating electricity.
And again, in plain English?
There's nobody that's pricing in carbon or any sorts of pollution. Once the consumer starts to realize what the actual cost is of the electricity and the goods and services that they're using, they will make the appropriate decisions, and then resources will be allocated most efficiently when everyone's paying the real costs.
Lee's professors agree, but they say taxes are a much harder sell politically than cap and trade, which has the broad backing of Wall Street types keen to capitalize on green trade wherever it happens. In the end, California regulators could opt for both cap and trade and taxes. If you're ready to move beyond today's lesson in carbon trading, check out our reading list at californiareport.org. Remember Point Break, that cheesy early 90s action movie about bank-robbing surfers disguised as ex-U.S. presidents? It starred Keanu Reeves as a rookie FBI agent sent to catch Bodie, a pipeline-chasing thief played by Patrick Swayze. The movie's gained cult classic status, and now it's been resurrected for the stage. Ali Tabatabai caught a recent show.
Point Break Live is both a lampoon and tribute to the original box office hit.
It's one of those movies you love to hate because it's very frustrating because it's so bad, but it's entertaining because it's so bad.
Lee Stoneman plays a character in the stage adaptation, which has one big twist. Every night, someone is picked out of the audience to play the lead role, Keanu Reeves' special agent, Johnny Utah.
Anyone can come in here and play the character. They read the lines off cue cards. And they get a video of their performance afterwards.
The play is a lighthearted jab at Keanu's less-than-Oscar-worthy performance in the film. Keanu, Keanu, Keanu. The play's creators, Jamie Keeling and Jamie Hook, were so in love with Point Break, they wanted to bring the film to life. For the last 9 months, Point Break Live has been running in Los Angeles so successfully that the show's producers opened up another run in San Francisco, hiring an all-new cast of local talent.
It's definitely a show where you come to laugh. It is not Shakespeare. It's about as opposite to Shakespeare as you can get.
San Francisco cast member Sharon Rylander plays the film's original director, Catherine Bigelow. Since the play is set up like a fake movie production, Rylander runs the auditions for Johnny Utah at the start of each show. Before the actual play starts, Keanu hopefuls must prove to the crowd that they're right for the part. And whoever gets the most applause wins the role.
Hi, my name is Johnny Utah.
Hi, my name is Johnny Utah.
All right. Excellent.
Tonight, the crowd picks 25-year-old architect Bethany Snyder, San Francisco's first ever female Keanu. If you go, don't pass on the $1 survival kit offered in the lobby. Its emergency poncho will keep you dry during high tide, and the wad of fake money helps stave off the bank-robbing presidents. They ransack the audience throughout the show.
Action!
Moments into the first act, out come those pesky gunslinging bank robbers. Later on, Bethany Snyder channels her inner Keanu, reading her lines off cue cards.
Maybe I can do better than some over-the-hill burnout.
In the play's finale, Johnny finally tracks down Bodie in Australia. He's trying to catch a killer tidal wave in the middle of the biggest storm in 50 years, recreated on stage by cooling fans and squirt guns. All riled up now, the crowd gets behind Bodie's plea for one last ride before facing justice. As Bodie dashes out into the sea, the audience delivers the show's final signature line. That's Vaya con Dios in Johnny's best Spanish. In the end, Snyder's not entirely wiped out from the experience. In fact, she may have even caught the acting bug.
Is this going to be a launching pad for your acting career?
Definitely. Hollywood, here I come.
You can catch Point Break live at San Francisco's Xenodrome Theater through the end of June, or at the Dragonfly in Hollywood until the tide goes out. For the California Report, I am Johnny Utah. I mean, Ali Tabatabai.
Since the early days of the AIDS crisis, federal policy has banned gay men from giving blood in order to prevent the spread of HIV. Gay activists say the policy made sense when HIV tests were crude, but given the accuracy of today's screenings, they say the federal policy is now just plain discriminatory. Some college campuses in Northern California have banned blood drives altogether. Other campuses are finding ways to protest without reducing the region's already vulnerable blood supply. Sarah Varney has more.
You take the first 80 numbers, okay, 1 through 80.
Sonoma State University professor Rick Luttman stands over a table of befuddled math students.
In this problem, you're picking five numbers.
At 68 years old, dressed in a faded purple shirt and mismatched pants, Luttman seems an unlikely target for threatening late-night phone calls.
One guy called up and just screamed into the phone, "No contaminated blood."
Luttman has become a reviled celebrity of sorts in the small town of Rohnert Park. The Sonoma State faculty there recently approved his resolution to ban campus blood drives. The university's president overrode that decision, but the idea has caught on among gay activists. Luttman got the idea earlier this year after San Jose State University and two nearby community colleges passed their own bans. Luttman believes the blood drives violate Sonoma State's anti-discrimination policy because the FDA doesn't allow men to donate blood if they've had sex with another man, even once, since 1977.
They'll argue that we don't ask the G word, that, you know, are you gay? They don't ask that. A young person, for instance, might never have had sex. But basically, it's going to sweep in virtually all gay men.
Blood banks around California say they're worried more campuses will ban blood drives. Blood Bank of the Redwoods president Kathy Bryan says colleges are reliable and critical contributors to area blood supplies.
Without the college and their frequent drives, we would have difficulty providing to our patients. Probably more strongly put, we would have a very critical situation.
The blood banks and the Red Cross are lobbying the FDA to change the lifetime ban on gay men. Other high-risk groups like heterosexuals who've paid for sex or had multiple partners can donate after waiting 12 months. The blood banks and activists like Luttman say the same rules should apply to gay men. The FDA says the policy is in place to protect the blood supply, and the risk of HIV infection through a transfusion is the lowest it's ever been, just one in every 2 million pints of blood. The FDA declined to be interviewed on tape, but in an emailed statement said men who have sex with men still have the highest risk for HIV, and allowing them to donate would increase the likelihood of infection. David Magnus is director of Stanford's Center for Biomedical Ethics. He says the FDA's logic doesn't hold up because screening tests can detect HIV in donated blood within weeks of an infection and are 99.98% accurate.
We can have policies and testing that make it safe and effective for gay men to donate blood, and therefore excluding them when their level of risk is comparable to many, many other groups seems simply discriminatory.
In Berkeley, blood shortages are the norm. Hospitals here routinely rely on imported blood because not enough people donate. UC Berkeley student Jeff Monacero, who's gay, says he wanted to find a way to protest the FDA's ban without jeopardizing the blood supply.
When I first started disseminating the idea, I had to make the rounds and go to all of the different LGBT corners on campus, and most people were extremely receptive and excited about the idea, but there were definitely a few people that they would have preferred a more adversarial approach, I think.
For the past 2 years, Monacero has organized gay men on campus to find others to donate blood in their name.
And sort of like, you know, during Christmas or Hanukkah time when people will go and pick a child's name and get them a gift, we have folks come to the table and choose someone's name to give in their name.
It's a form of protest, Monacero says, that adds to the blood supply and educates people about the FDA's policy.
Taking blood out of your body, it's a very, you know, tangible process. It's not like you're just signing a petition or going somewhere to represent someone. You're actually giving part of you to someone else in their name. So in that way, I think it's really a unique, special way of connecting with someone and being able to make a difference for that person.
Local blood centers have applauded Monacero's efforts, and University of California officials are considering making a video to educate sororities, fraternities, and other campus groups about how to hold blood drives that find donors for gay male students. Sonoma State Professor Luttman says he supports the blood banks and regrets they've become the target of his demonstrations. But Luttman says the federal ban on gay blood donors could last for decades, and he had to decide what to do in the meantime.
We have our principles. We have a non-discrimination policy on the campus. We don't control the nation. We're not Congress. But we can control what happens on our campus.
Under the rules Luttman, Montesero, and the blood banks all support, gay men who haven't had sex for 12 months could donate blood. That means monogamous, same-sex couples who might soon be married in California would still be barred from blood drives. For the California Report, I'm Sarah Varney.
Boxing, prisons, and hanging out with the boys are usually topics for male songwriters and singers, but one-time East L.A. mainstay Ercy Arvizu covers all that and more in her first solo album. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hawkman calls it a terrific album, featuring colorful tales of life both in and out of music.
Autobiography in music is a tricky business. For every ballad of John and Yoko and Coal Miner's Daughter, there are dozens of maudlin, trite, or just plain tedious examples. Few lives really lend themselves to compelling songs. But just look into the eyes staring out from Ercy Arvizu's face on the cover of her new album, Friend for Life, and you know she's got stories to tell.
Seems life been a long and winding road. Met a lot of people along the way. I try to walk the straight and narrow path. It may not be perfect, but I take it day by day.
It was the look in those eyes, staring from an older photo, that led Ry Cooter to seek out Arvizu to contribute to the music for a stage production about the development of Chavez Ravine. The photo Cooter saw came from 1963, when then-teenaged Arvizu was singing in the East L.A. group The Sisters. A lot has happened between that shot and the one on the new release, and it's all in the music. The opening track, Windows of Dreams, sets the tone, evoking her youthful days as a boxer, paying tribute to a roster of male fighters, and in the end, placing her firmly in their ranks.
As a child, I couldn't resist looking through the hole from afar. I see the dedication and sacrifice. I would love to see them spar. As I grew up, I knew that I was ready for the world to see. I trained hard to gain respect. $1 million baby had nothing on me.
Rapping the raps.
In the 70s, Arvizu was in another male bastion, the lone female member of seminal Latin rock band El Chicano. Writing about that time period, she wisely avoids trying to squeeze the whole experience into one song, but focuses on one vivid episode, a tense visit to a California prison for a band performance. The tale could fill out a dramatic short story or film, but packed into song form on El Tambo, it's a gripping narrative with a steely delivery.
En El Tambo, es una aventura. En El Tambo, la vida es muy dura.
In our travels, we did a show at Tehachapi State Pen. Pretty nervous being the only woman in a sea of men. Arriving there, we met at the gate by inmates who let us in. Nothing sounds quite the same as those gates closing the city of sin.
En El Tambo, es una aventura. En El Tambo.
Cooter gets a lot of credit for this album's high standards, shaping the tracks in a spirit true to the East L.A. origins without being retro. It's more a sense of impressionism fitting the memories than literal recreation of time and place. And while he contributes his own distinctive guitar to some of the songs, he never imposes himself, rather becoming part of the sound paintings behind Arvizu's words and voice, as in Soledad.
Ya no puede ser, y ya no te quiero ver jamás. Ya no puede ser, y ya no te quiero ver jamás. Ya no puede ser, y ya no te quiero ver jamás. Ya no puede ser, y ya no te puedo ver jamás. El amor.
This is not about nostalgia or about righting a wrong, but about recognizing that great art comes from experience and maturity. And Arvizu has plenty of that, having worked largely outside of music for a few decades now. But even with that and with such songs as Cruising to the Hop, that face on the album cover is not looking back. Those eyes are staring down whatever the present has to offer. And from Arvizu, It offers music and words worthy of the life they describe.
Steve Hawkman covers pop music for the LA Times, and he writes the global music column Around the World for Spinner.com. He reviewed Friend for Life by Ersi Arvizu. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Tom Kumkowski. This week we say goodbye to our spring crop of interns, Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, June Stinson, and Leanne Lucetta. We wish you the best of luck and many thanks for your good work. We also say goodbye, for now, to our producer Victoria Mauleon, who's leaving us for a very good reason, to bring another radio producer into the world. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Raul Ramirez is the executive producer. I'm Rachel Miro. Scott Schaefer returns next week. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.